Bonjour, friends, and welcome to Whole Body Optimism for Healthcare Professionals, the podcast that's all about embracing a modern approach to positivity, clean living, and personal growth. I'm Dr. Chrissy, and I'll be your guide on this journey to a happier, healthier, and more optimistic you. So without further ado, please welcome Jane Lodato here on the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm delighted to be here. I am a chief of wellness in the surgery department system-wide at the Mount Sinai Hospital's health system in New York City.
Tell us about a little bit of chief of wellness in the surgery department. A lot of people that are listening are surgeons or have some interests. Maybe they're residents that are listening right now and they're thinking, wait, what the heck? How do we get a chief of wellness in a surgery department? And what does she bring to the surgery department? So I'd love to know, what has happened over the course of your time there? How did you get the job? What are you doing? And then I want to talk about some more of the things in the surgery department specifically.
So my background is one that's an unusual path, which many of us have in our lives at different points in our lives. And I was an executive in public global corporations in a couple of different industries, including sports, entertainment, and eventually tech and finance for almost 30 years. And I was at the C-suite level in charge of marketing for several big companies. And I'm a single mom, a solo mom. I was raising a daughter on my own and living in San Francisco, LA, or New York. And I found that the stress that I experienced personally trying to be a corporate executive along with a solo mom would ramp up, as it does for any working parent, I'm sure. And I've always been somebody who's done yoga and studied mindfulness meditation. And that, in effect, became my refuge and salvation from my day to day. And at one point in time, I was experiencing migraine headaches and high blood pressure. And I found that the more that I focused on my mindfulness practice, those things eventually just completely disappeared. It changed my relationship with stress. And my curiosity led me to continue to study mindfulness and eventually to go become certified as a mindfulness teacher. My two primary teachers are two people who are well known in the field, Jack Kornfield and Tara Brock, and UC Berkeley offers, through their Greater Good Science Center, a program that's a two-year training program. And I was accepted to and completed that. And then I went on to study various specialties, like working with anxiety, working with anger, working with fear.
I'm sure you see a lot of those in surgery.
You do, and became certified as a mindfulness mentor, which means I can work comfortably one-on-one with people in addition to teaching classes. So there was a timely moment when I crossed paths with the chair of surgery at Mount Sinai, Dr. Michael Marin, who is a visionary. This was pre-COVID, and he really wanted to do whatever he could to support his staff. And as you know, burnout and even thoughts of suicide are extremely prevalent in the medical profession and in surgery, with the inherent stress that comes with the profession.
Definitely.
And rather than embedding a therapist in the department, which he didn't think would necessarily be as easily received at that point in time, he chose to embed me in the department, because having someone in the department who could work one-on-one with people and also teach group classes — I'm part of the residence curriculum, and I work with the administration leadership teams as well — but the plus to embedding someone at the department level is easy access. And as you know, for surgeons, that is half the battle.
That's the key. And I think for us too, it's consistency. You're this face they see all the time for it. There are so many available apps, or even your trying out the flavor of the different therapists in town, you have to tell your story over and over, or the apps, you're meeting different people, whereas you're the constant face that they see and you have your pulse on the department. You know what's going on.
It's true. And that has been very helpful. And I have dedicated myself to mining their stress as much as I can. I'll join in on a surgery, for example, just to observe and and really working hard at understanding what it's like to be in your or their shoes. And I think the benefit, as you say, of the familiarity, here's somebody I know, here's somebody hopefully that I trust. Our meetings are 100% confidential. They're not logged in Epic. My calendar is only seen by me, and I can meet them when and where, whether it's on Zoom or in person. That works great for them. And so we really have, I've been meeting one-on-one with our leadership division specialty chiefs, of which we have many because we are a system of 8 hospitals.
That's
for 4 years now, every single week for 4 years.
Wow.
And I just feel incredibly fortunate to have those relationships within the department. Because if the leadership team adapts the idea of wellness in any form and they model that behavior, it tends to trickle down. And I will say that our residents have been fabulous too, with chief residents in particular, paving the way for all residents to just take a little time out to figure out how they can help themselves.
Yeah, totally. So what I'm hearing from you and what I think we hear and we talk about a lot of times is when you have buy-in at a leadership level, and when you have them understanding the importance of a mindfulness practice, a lot of the things that you're teaching them, you don't necessarily have to go down to the resident, the student level, and reinvent a system whenever, if you can get your role models to understand it, practice it, then that's going to be something that they model to the trainees and the students around them.
I think that's accurate. And it also helps. It's sort of, my approach is two-pronged. I'd say top down is essential.
Mm-hmm.
Without the advocacy of the chair and the leadership, it wouldn't work. I think, because it's like, who is this person? What's she doing here?
Right.
But also, from the resident level, I'm their advocate to GME at the institutional level. So I know what they're going through and I fight for them to try to make certain things happen.
That's really nice.
I really do genuinely care about their well-being, and they're making the training as good as it can possibly be in every single way for them, which includes what can we do to alleviate some of the burnout.
Right. Now, you said you're a part of their curriculum. Is it like a mindfulness training that you do with the residents once a year, once a quarter? What does that look like? And what do the residents think?
I teach a class series that I have coined the Surgeon's Six. It's a series of six classes. Yeah. And typically the PGY1s or 2s, we will find 6 consecutive weeks during their protected time when we can meet for 30 to 45 minutes on Zoom, because that seems to work best for them.
Sure.
And I will go through some experiential exercises that they can pull out of their hip pocket at any point during the day. And then we will talk about certain situations that any or all of them come up against, and what type of a mindfulness tool might we be able to apply in a situation like that. So my goal is to try to help them utilize tools in real time, in addition to giving them long-term mental skill set that will serve them always.
Right. And I think they may not realize it now, but when you're getting the training, when you're younger, you're moldable, when you're learning how to use all the tools in your toolbox at a trainee, at a residency level, you are going to take that along to when you're a chief resident, when you're a new attending. And really, it's going to be something that translates to how you treat people even outside of the hospital. So I think that's an incredible work.
You're very astute. I think that's true. And something interesting is sometimes I'll teach a class to the PGY1s, and maybe 2-3 years later, any of them might circle back and want to work with me one-on-one.
Wow.
So somehow over time, something stuck that was helpful, maybe one exercise. And then their curiosity might lead them back to wanting to learn more. And it really is a mental skill set, Chrissy. So like any other skill, it's something that we can develop with practice. And this one I find really has changed relationships with anxiety, frustration, anger, fear.
Sure.
All that we as human beings experience.
Totally. Now, for the listeners that are listening, you know, if you don't have someone in your department, what can you teach us, you know, Jane, what is one strategy and like a practical use of that? So for residents, faculty, or attendings listening, or any healthcare professional, really, that's treating patients, having a stressful, you know, environment at the hospital. Do you have like a tip that you can teach someone if they experience anxiety or, you know, frustration, a difficult interaction, you know, between, let's say, a nurse and a doctor, or, you know, any kind of ancillary staff that you just, it flusters you?
I can think of a couple of things, and I'll try to sort of simplify or consolidate the thought where really there is more to it, but typically, when an event happens that upsets us, whether it's a conversation or being in a certain circumstance, we react concurrently with that event. For example, Chrissy, if you said something that upset me, or I thought, oh, this is giving me anxiety, if we were in the OR together and you critiqued me, or I interpreted it as critique, where in fact you are teaching me, I would react concurrently with that, whatever the event was. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of mindfulness is that I can take a step back and realize that my autopilot reaction is kicking in, because most of these things are habitual. Mm-hmm. It's just what we have always done and we know to do, and we keep doing it. And so whether it's anger or anxiety, we have this instantaneous concurrent reaction. Well, the benefit of mindfulness is that if one can literally pause for even a second, or better yet, you know, several breaths, you can take a step back and identify the fact that, whoa, here comes my anxiety, here comes my anger. I feel it. Chances are you feel it somewhere in your body. Your chest may tighten, your stomach may feel like it has a pit. Your jaw may tighten. And then you can sort of insert a little pause and think, okay, am I going to be carried away by that reactivity? Is it going to sort of have the reins? Or can I take this step back and think, okay, this is me getting anxious again. This is me wanting to get angry. And instead, perhaps choose a more thoughtful response that will cause less stress in the long run, because if I get angry and I blow up, there are going to be repercussions and I'm going to carry this around. If I'm anxious, I might be churning or ruminating for days. But if I can insert that mindful pause, I will spare myself some of my own grief and stress. So how does one do that? That's the question you wanted to know. I think the simplest thing is when you feel yourself ramping up into reactivity, which we all do. There's nothing wrong with that. It's how we're wired as human beings. A lot of this is based in, it is all based actually in neuroscience. There's a lot of data and research that is evidence-based that shows these things really work. Taking a few deep breaths Mm-hmm. They say 90 seconds of deep breaths, which is the equivalent of maybe 10 at the most. But, and that's not always possible. So maybe it's one or two or three, but breathing in through the nose, inflating the chest and the belly fully, and then mm-hmm. exhaling through the mouth as slowly as possible, letting it go. And mm-hmm. do a couple of those just to actually literally try to reset and try to get a notch more grounded. And then we can ask questions like, wait, am I being criticized? Or is this just, is this a learning environment? And this is how this person thinks they're helping me.
Right.
We often take things so personally
that aren't
personal.
Yeah. Just a like review for the listeners. So I think it's important to note, we may have these feelings that pop up that if someone says something uncomfortable to us and we have our own programmed subconscious way of reacting to certain situations, whether it be avoidance, whether it be anxiety, whether it be anger, everybody has their own way of projecting how that uncomfortable interaction goes. And so I think what Jane's saying here is, hey, like, let's identify it first. Let's figure out, how does my body feel when this happens? And get more comfortable identifying, putting your finger on, okay, here's that moment. Here's that moment where someone, you may be feeling shame. You may be feeling like you're unworthy of taking care of this patient because you were called out for not knowing how to tie a knot or something. And you really have to stop and think, okay, why, this is how I'm feeling right now. Let's take a step back. Let's take a deep breath. And even if you don't have, like you said, minutes to take 10 deep breaths, even just one or two, I think are very helpful to sort of reset your intention of how you're going to respond next. I think that's just so key.
It's so key, and it's not easy to do. And
no.
The other part of this is to be kind and actually compassionate to yourself. So if it's not possible to do that in the moment, yet you walk away from whatever this is, and there's a degree of residual emotion, which is common, right? I mean, that's
totally common.
True. In hindsight, you can look back and sort of just ask a question, what was I thinking? And is that really true? Because what we learn from just posing those questions is that so many of the thoughts that pop into our brain, they're all very real. We have them. I mean, they're happening, and we can't turn that off, as far as I know.
Right.
But so many of them come with storylines that aren't necessarily true. Like, I'm not enough, or I screwed up, or that person hates me, or whatever that storyline may be. So it's simply pretending that you're an observer and asking this question, you know, is what I'm believing in this situation really, really true?
Right.
And then being kind to yourself about it and seeing if you can sort of befriend yourself. It's one aside here that's really interesting, I think, and you tell me, but
yeah, totally. And then
a lot of research has been done on self-compassion.
Totally.
And it's been shown that those of us who are able to take a look at something and treat ourselves like we would a best friend or
correct.
A loved one actually become more resilient. And that's a word that's kind of loaded. But the truth is, if you can sort of understand and forgive yourself and go forward and say, hey, I'm human. Welcome to the human race. What happens over time is that these are the people who can kind of continue with greater resilience in a very, in a positive way. I don't mean be strong and
Totally. Yeah, you just get immune to the self-critic in you. And I tend to do this a lot, and I share this with some of my close friends that are surgeons as well, is like, whenever I have a complication, or whenever they're, you know, I'm facing like, oh, this patient had a complication, and I'm hard on myself about it. I think that's just the inner perfectionistic surgeon attitude a lot of people share, but you feel like this immense guilt whenever you have this complication. And how am I going to stand up at M&M whenever the resident's talking about it and defend myself to my colleagues, to my partners, things like that. And ultimately to the patient's family, if it's a terrible complication that you have to disclose. So a lot of imposter syndrome in that. But what I tend to do is, and I do this quite frequently, is I'll imagine one of my best friends in that position, having that same complication. And like you said, like when you imagine your friend in that situation and how you're going to treat your friend, and then taking that self-talk and changing the narrative in your brain to reflect what you would tell your best friend, that's the essence of self-compassion.
I love hearing that. And that's so true. You hit the nail on the head. And I think it's not something that's innate, particularly in our culture and particularly in the surgical profession, because you have to compartmentalize in a way in order to do what you do, right? Right. But then these feelings that come with that cannot be swept under the rug or shrugged off. That's where burnout begins.
Oh, totally.
It's stressful to carry that stuff around.
Now, I'm interested to hear, I'm a huge fan of Brené Brown. Shout out to Brené Brown for teaching all she does on shame and resilience and just being brave and courageous and vulnerable. I am interested to hear your thoughts about Morbidity and Mortality Conference, and if residents talk about it or faculty talk about it, and if shame is talked about in those situations.
That's a great question. I think the M&Ms serve a great purpose, of course, because they're a teaching experience. And I think that's one thing that everybody needs to bear in mind, that it's mm-hmm. not meant to shame. It's meant
Correct.
To teach.
Correct.
And keeping that framework is important, because there isn't one person who attends the M&Ms who hasn't been in a similar situation.
Totally.
And so it isn't just you who's presenting, and
right.
It's really, but it's painful. So I attend the M&Ms, and part of my role is, if someone has presented a particular case that sounds distressing to a certain degree, which they all are to any degree, but
right.
And if the questions that they're being asked, the tone of the questions and the tenor of the questions feel harsh in a way, I always reach out to whomever is presenting in that situation afterwards, just to see if they want to meet or debrief, or just try to say, hey, you really did a great job under pressure. I mean, which you all do. It's grace under pressure. That's a stressful situation to be presenting in the first place. And so while I think the M&Ms are terrific in terms of being a teaching tool, I think they are also an opportunity to practice what you were just describing with some self-compassion, and or reaching out. Everybody should have a buddy or a mentor to talk to when a complication arises, to debrief, because I think just verbally unloading it and getting some perspective from somebody else can be really helpful in moving forward. Shame is it's a tough thing. We all are prone to doing that. I don't know if you've heard Rick Hansen, who's a mindfulness teacher, talk about the negativity bias that the brain has. He's grounded as a neuroscientist as well, I believe. But our brain, they say, takes anything that we perceive as negative, a comment, a situation, and it sticks in the brain like Velcro.
Right.
And then they say anything that's positive flies right out of the brain, like flying off of a Teflon pan. And so the brain, literally, humans' brains are wired for a negativity bias. And that's something to keep in mind too, because you can almost just say, okay, here comes my negativity bias. I'm beating up on myself. I'm feeling shame, but really I'm in a really tough profession. I'm human. This was a situation that nobody would like to find themselves in. And I did the best I could under difficult circumstances. And that's enough. That's more than enough, really.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. It's really difficult. And a lot of times it's easy to say, like, we should be more empathetic to the residents and whoever's presenting. But when you have to do it yourself, it's really hard to really practice the self-compassion to yourself. So if you're a resident or a new attending listening right now, or anyone that talks about complications in a setting, it doesn't have to necessarily be surgery. You don't even have to necessarily be physician. You could be any ancillary staff, nurse, respiratory tech, whatever. When you're discussing complications, it's normal to feel guilty. You know, and there's a healthy amount of guilt that goes into discussing complications. But it's when you project shame onto yourself and thinking, I'm not worthy, not just what I did was something that I could have done better. If you start self-talking yourself, I'm a bad person, that's whenever you really have to practice your mindfulness, really step back and say, hey, this is not good for my mental, physical health. I need to change the way I'm talking to myself. I need to change the narrative behind this. And maybe you see someone else do it and you step them through it because you become aware of it in the present moment. I think this is so helpful. And I definitely think the surgical subspecialties are prone to this even more because we have those conferences where we talk about the complications all the time. So I get it. And you're right. You become more resilient. And I also hate using the word. I feel like it's overused and people just think, oh, well, you know, I should be more resilient, then I wouldn't take it personal. No, there is a certain degree where you have to really get immune. I like the word immune, really, to the negative self-critic.
I agree with you. I am not a fan of the word resilient because I feel like it holds the bar higher for us. Like we're supposed to be super strong, and immune is an interesting concept, but we need to just sort of somehow in life, and this is, it's a tough world out there right now, and discouraging in so many ways. We need to be able to forge forward and find the good. I also, when I'm working one-on-one with our surgeons or residents or anybody on our staff, we take a moment in each session to just think about what went well that day.
There must be
something. It could be a little thing. You might see a dog on a sidewalk that cracked you up. You might have had a great cup of coffee, or had one patient or one attending say one thing that made you feel good. And I think it's really important. The flip side of this also is just to take a moment when you're climbing into bed and ask, you know, what went well today?
Yes.
One little thing, just to remember so we don't miss these moments of our lives.
Totally. I totally agree. And I encourage my trainees, my clients all, to cultivate a practice of gratitude. Set an 8 p.m. alarm on your phone so that every night at 8 p.m. when the alarm goes off, you're constantly thinking, okay, what went well today? What am I grateful for in this very day that I can acknowledge? Yeah, maybe if it's a dog that you saw that made you laugh, or a reel that was funny or something, or a patient that cracked a joke with you, or a patient that farted or something silly, just anything that made the day so much more pleasant to be in.
I agree. It's actually been shown that if you keep a gratitude journal and you put 3 bullets every night, takes 2 minutes at the most. If you can do that for 30 days, it starts to shift your brain a bit.
Yeah,
that's worth it. So practice.
Well, I thank you so much for all your helpful tools, you know, and I understand you do some one-on-one private coaching as well and mindfulness practice sharing, teaching, and I will put in the podcast notes how you can get in touch with Jane Lodato about this. And I appreciate you just really blazing the trail in the departments of surgery. I know that when more people know and leadership gets involved and buy into this type of framework for their surgery department, you're going to get a lot more calls.
Well, I am so delighted to help anybody in any way I can. And I am particularly appreciative and grateful to our chair, Dr. Marin, for having the vision and the foresight to take a chance on trying this model.
Wow.
Pre-COVID.
Yeah.
So hats off to him for paving the way.
I love that. I love
yeah.
that.
But I would be happy to connect with anyone who would like to and try to. I consult to some surgery departments around the country to try to just help them get set up.
Nice.
Figure out what next steps would be. So thank you, though, so much for. I love talking with you and
same.
Your point of view and wisdom is something that everybody's lucky to have access to.
Oh, well, I appreciate you and I plan to keep in touch, of course, and I love to see what's happening in your world and follow us and along our journey. And I'd love to hear your comments about what wellness is doing in your surgery department, in your department, wherever you are across the country. So keep us posted and I'll see y'all real soon.
Thanks, Chrissy.
Thank you so much for joining us on this uplifting journey through whole body optimism for healthcare professionals. We really hope you found this episode today as enlightening and inspiring as we did. Remember, optimism isn't just a state of mind, it's a way of life. And you have the power to shape your own destiny. Be sure to follow us on this podcast and on Instagram and Facebook to learn more about practical and simple tips to find your true whole body optimism.